maybe some compensation element somewhere down the line, but I think it is possible to do, at least the way I've described it in here, and it is possible to do in a way that Congress can carry that authority out. That would either be placing the land back in trust, or it might be limiting the sale of the land, might be limiting the voting rights of the stock, it might be placing the land under certain restrictions or whatever. That power is in Congress to carry out as it, in its political wisdom, is appropriate. There could be a constitutional amendment, and I'll remark about a couple of possibilities a little bit later. A constitutional amendment, incidentally, is what the Penner Report recommended in Canada. The reason is that a constitutional amendment, you entrench an idea in the Constitution, and it's there, in a sense, permanently. It's not quite permanently, but it's for a very long time. It's tough to remove it, and it does assure people of a future without the vacillations of changing political administrations. There is the possibility of administrative action in recognition of native government or native land tenure. One of the problems with that is that that's the most chimerical of all. That is, it can change, it can be affected by different political views. And the last one I've mentioned is self-help, the village of Accuchac, some of the other villages that have taken actions on their own part and can, in significant ways, affect their own futures. As far as the substantive alternatives, I've mentioned that one such substantive alternative is to either place the land of the villages, I would suggest, back in trust to restrict the sale or restrict voting rights. We have examples of that. The Menominee Termination Act of 1954, which went into effect, I guess, in 1961, and was undone in 1972, 73, in the Menominee Restoration Act, is an example where land was taken out of trust. The ownership of it was held by the members of the tribe as stockholders in a corporation, or hold certificates. They held certificates which were transferable into stock, and then went back into trust status. There's also another substantive alternative that could be considered, called a conservation easement. It has not been used in Alaska, to my knowledge, in any broad scale, but is a method by which an easement could be created which would be enduring. One can ask, well, does that remove the possibility of state taxation? It does not remove it explicitly, or it may not. That may depend on the legislation setting it up. But one thing would be true: if the land was burdened by a conservation easement, its value would be far less than it would be if it is sitting there as a potential for either timber harvest or development or whatever. So the tax base would be very low. Conservation easements might be designed for subsistence, for open space, for fragile ecosystems. Some things that would benefit the native population, some things that would mutually benefit the non-native population as well. The Alaska Land Bank looks something like that. The problem with the Alaska Land Bank, as far as this is concerned, is that a change in ownership or a change in attitude of the native population of the corporation can unbank the land, and then it's out of that protection. The conservation easement is a more permanent methodology. There might be legislation, congressional legislation, affirming sovereignty, affirming governing powers. One particular kind of either federal legislation or constitutional amendment or judicial action that might be achieved is by comparing to the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution. Let me put that a little bit simpler. If Congress passes a law affecting voting rights in the United States, a voting right is conceived to be a fundamental right. Any legislation that affects a fundamental right will receive strict scrutiny by the federal court system, which means that the courts will not simply say, oh, well, if Congress wants to do that, we'll accept Congress's motives. The courts will look at it strictly, go back through the background, ask, what does it do? How does it affect voting rights? And they will not sustain a law that affects voting rights, or I might say race relations, unless it is found to be necessary to achieve a compelling governmental interest. It's a tough test to meet. And the, in fact, if you look at the cases, you find that almost no legislation can meet that test if you're going to change the voting rights from a one person, one vote, or if you're going to enact legislation that bears especially upon people because of their race. Well, the result of that is that there's a very strong protection of the one person, one vote rule, and there's a very strong protection against racist legislation. Such legislation or such a constitutional amendment might be possible as one substantive response to protection of native land tenure or of native governmental power. Lastly, it seems to me that one of the movements that is very much in place in Canada and that is potentially in place in Alaska is that of negotiation, is recognition that there are legitimate rights, there are legitimate concerns, there are vital interests that are to be served by the native population, there are vital interests that are to be served of the non-native population, of the state and the federal government, but the way to handle that is to sit down at the table and negotiate. And I don't mean negotiate on the sense that you're going to take this and you're going to take that, but negotiate as was done, for example, in the Passamaquoddy settlement in the northeastern and the Maine area, and in the Menominee Restoration, where people sat down at the bargaining table and pounded it out, as we found in the Cope settlement, in the Northern Territory settlement in Canada. I think that's a movement that deserves most serious consideration. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Ralph. Well, with that overview in mind, maybe we should turn now to David Case and have him become very specific about this and advance an idea for village home rule in Alaska. So, David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the paper. I guess it's available. I will not read it either, thankfully, and attempt to summarize what I've put forward here in the paper. And I say in the paper, I think, that this is written from the standpoint of an advocate. In other words, it is the paper itself is advocating a particular approach to the questions of native land and governance in Alaska. There's a danger always in advocating anything. And that is the danger that one will say either too little, in other words, take a position that is giving up too much, or will say too much and attempt to take a position that stakes out too much territory and that is simply not defensible. There is also a danger, I suspect, in those of us who do not live in villages, to which this paper and this concept of village home rule is principally addressed. There's a danger for those of us who don't live in villages in advocating anything because we don't have to live with the consequences of that advocacy. Nonetheless, one is either faced with the choice of saying something or saying nothing, and for better or worse, I've chosen to say something. The paper is intended to be attacked and is intended to, as a matter of self-defense, to be something that is provocative of discussion and which I reserve the right to disavow. but in any event, I would like to put forward an idea for people to discuss if you wish, and I suppose you don't even have to do that. One final point, I guess. It should be clear that what I've written here and I'm about to say is not necessarily the position of the commission and does not pretend to prejudge that position. I think it's important for me to start out, as I do in the paper, by declaring some of the assumptions and the limits that I've put on my thinking about village home rule. And the first of these, and there are others that I mentioned in the paper, I'll just touch on a few of the more important ones. The first assumption or limit is that we are faced in Alaska, at least at the present, with an off-reservation situation. There's only one real reservation in which the lands are held in trust or restricted status, and that is Metlakatla. I believe, is a fundamental restriction on the ability to apply all the doctrines of Indian law assuredly in Alaska, the same way in which they can be applied with slightly more assurance in the lower 48, in the reservation situation. There's also, I think, it is my impression, a resistance in general to reservations in Alaska, not only among non-natives, where one would expect it, but among natives as well. Now, this is not true of all people in Alaska, of natives or non-natives. Indeed, there are some obvious places where reservations and the native communities in those places are, in fact, desiring and demanding and reservations and feel it has been an injustice that the reservations were terminated in the first place. And of course, I'm speaking of Venati in particular. There are other places in Alaska where reservations would seem to be, if they are desired by the people living there, a positive development. And those are places in particular where there are large areas of land under village, corporation, or tribal ownership, which are isolated. Those seem to me to be the best situations where a reservation kind of structure would work. And I guess I'm thinking there of St. Lawrence Island, for example, Venati, the former Chandelier Reserve, and even Tetlin, which is a large area. Which is not to say that people there wish those things, but those offer large areas of land over which the problems of defining jurisdiction are simplified and all the rest. So I'm not suggesting that what I've called village home rule is the answer by any means for everybody or even anybody. But I do think, and this paper does address, the question of land and governance in village situations. And by that, I am excluding regional corporation situations or regional land holding situations. I'm not suggesting that home rule is a concept that could apply to an entire region, native region or native corporate region in Alaska. But it has its application principally, in my mind, to isolated villages with small populations, which I think are the villages in which this commission has focused its inquiry. Finally, in the way of an introduction, I have skewed or slanted my title of this paper to imply that what I'm suggesting is practical. You should be aware of that. That's a loaded term, of course. Practical means, to some people in any way, that it's a good idea. It's good just because it's practical. But practicality implies some kind of compromise, and compromise between competing interests that will be addressed in the course of reaching some, quote, practical conclusions. It also assumes that things as they are now. It assumes that the doctrines of federal Indian law, as best we can understand them, are as they are now. It assumes that there are no reservations in Alaska or no general authority to create new reservations in Alaska. But things, I think we should remember, can and have changed. And Ada Deer reminded us of that at one of the very first roundtables that this commission held. When the Menominee were, quote, terminated, it was viewed by many a few years later just impossible, crazy, outrageous that the Menominee could ever be restored. Nevertheless, Ada Deer has described it to us. The thinking, the assumptions that people had regarding the Menominee changed, and they changed because the significant numbers of people that were affected by the Menominee termination, the Menominee themselves, made them change. And that can and could happen in Alaska, in which case perhaps village home rule would be saying too little. So, needless to say, if things change, then one's view of what's practical also will change. And I'll leave that caveat. Well, what do I mean by village home rule? To me, it is a two-pronged idea. It means, on the one hand, that there are substantial powers of self-government, home rule, that would be exercised and clearly lodged and unquestioned in a village. And the second part of the idea is that these are in villages, small communities, not home rule boroughs, not communities of, not even first-class cities with 400 or more people, which is the current requirement, the current first hurdle on the way to home rule in the state under municipal law, is that you have to have be first a community of 400 people in order to be able to obtain a home rule charter. So I'm suggesting that there is room and a place, indeed, for home rule, substantial control at the village level, even outside of a reservation and outside of the municipal laws of the state of Alaska. It is, in short, an idea which, to me, seems to be one way to bridge the gap between the expectations of and aspirations that village people have for self-government and sovereignty, and the political philosophy of the state, which is opposed to those ideas, at least as far as anyone can tell, and but which, on the other hand, accepts the idea, at least in terms of municipal government, of home rule. And indeed, home rule and local control is an ideal that is entrenched, if you will, in the Alaska state constitution. And I'm simply suggesting that the concept of Native American sovereignty is an ideal that is also consistent with that ideal in the Alaska state constitution. In other words, it lodges village home rule, Native American sovereignty, lodges self-government at the local level, and assumes that that government has substantial powers unless proven otherwise. Why am I suggesting that there should be such a thing as village home rule? Well, first, I take it as a given that in most villages, that is, villages that have corporations with relatively small land holdings, few assets, that in most villages, these corporations simply aren't working. And they are putting, and more than that, they put the lands, the ancestral lands that are retained under the Claims Act, at great risk. And the corporations themselves are subject to either corporate failure or takeover by outside interests, and that these risks are simply unacceptable. There has to be another institution to assure that a land and community control will exist into the future, and the profit-making corporation isn't it. And perhaps I say that with too much conviction, but nonetheless, it is the assumption that I have made here.
Nothing should be said with conviction. It's always a mistake.
Too much conviction. The other point is as to why there should be a village home rule or something like it is that there are simply too many institutions in most villages. Most villages, we've heard it said over and over again, will have typically four, if they're lucky, institutions, and may have, in fact, many more. There may be a municipal government, a municipal council, a tribal government, either IRA or traditional council, a village corporation board, and then an advisory school board in most communities. And then there will be people in the communities who will be called upon to act in or interact with subsistence committees, local subsistence committees under ANILCA and state law, who will then also be required to interact with regional subsistence councils. and you may even have participation in a coastal resource management area council. And it goes on and on. That's not the end of it. There are many, many institutions that affect or with which these communities have to interact, and it is absolutely ridiculous, as we hear, from a community of 25 to 200 people to have the necessary individuals to interact with all of that. They are simply being overwhelmed by outside institutions, and the result is that people in these communities don't have power. And they are, in effect, even though they may have the aura of being consulted about things, there are too many places that you have to go to have your, quote, input, a very powerless word, I would suggest, into state decision-making. And that is something that is not good. It is not good from a village standpoint, and I would suggest it is not good from a state policy standpoint either. Finally, perhaps not finally, another point, as to village home rule, I guess I see it as one way to resolve by negotiation, and there are risks in negotiation, but in terms of a strategy to approach these things, it is one way to resolve the uncertainties of off-reservation jurisdiction. In other words, to negotiate the scope of village home rule in an off-reservation context, as Alaska, would be one way to resolve these jurisdictional questions without creating new reservations. But it would be a way to reserve, if you will, in law and in people's heads and in the legislature's mind, if there is such a thing, the scope of Native American rule in Alaska Native communities. As I've said before, home rule, as I've suggested, implies a partial satisfaction of competing interests. And that means, I think it should be said, that everybody loses something. And that maybe is the negative way to look at compromise. You can also look at it as everybody gaining something. And of course, the main thing that one gains in a compromise and a negotiated settlement is certainty. As to the result. And so I suggest that what I've described as village home rule in this paper may be a scenario, and this may be a red flag, but a scenario for the possible negotiation of the scope of Native sovereignty. And if you are unhappy with the scenario when you get done with the paper or listening to this discussion, then I would suggest that you may be unhappy with negotiation as a way to approach this this issue. Let me turn now to what I think that village home rule would do for the 1991 issues. Or at least some of them. And there are two that I guess I'm principally addressing. One is the question of land protection. We've heard it cussed and discussed as to the effect that Native sovereign ownership of land might have on the protection of that land from all the various risks, corporate loss, taxation, and so forth. And I guess this is an idea, the more I think about it, the more I think it will really work. And that is that the idea of Native American sovereignty carries with it the legal immunity of the sovereign from suit. And so it is impossible for a, since these things have to be resolved in the courts of the United States or the state, it is impossible for a creditor or any other one dissatisfied with the Native government to sue it and to acquire principally its lands or other assets by judicial procedure. It is a procedural impossibility. May have a, in other words, the dissatisfied person may have a legal right against a government, whether it's the United States government, the state, or a Native government, but it has no remedy. And the result is just as good for as far as the government is concerned, as not as the creditor or other person opposed not having any right at all. There has been some question, of course, whether Native communities in Alaska have sovereignty or sovereign immunity, a question which I think is answered with the response that yes, they do, but recognizing that courts can change a lawyer's idea or firm conviction. Beyond that, though, there are statutes which I don't think can be read any other way but to say that if a Native community in Alaska has complied with these statutes or falls under them, that they do indeed have the power to prevent the disposition of their lands or assets without their consent. And that is one of the specific provisions of the Indian Reorganization Act. And I can't imagine that it means anything more or less than what it says. And that is that Native tribes organized under the IRA, whatever else they may be able to do or whatever other powers they have, can indeed prevent the loss or disposition of their lands without their or other assets without their consent. And maybe I'm just slow on the uptake, but I can't see that a statute that says that means anything else. Finally, there is the question of the Indian Non-Intercourse Act in Alaska. The solicitor, as probably we are most of us aware, and for whatever it's worth, some years ago said that the Non-Intercourse Act, which prohibits the disposition or alienation of tribal lands without a treaty, doesn't apply in Alaska, or at least it doesn't apply to ANCSA lands. And that is a conclusion that is that every scholar I've ever talked to says, what, you've got to be kidding. But nonetheless, that is the conclusion of the solicitor. If the Non-Intercourse Act were to be held to apply, then it would be an additional protection for all tribally owned lands, whether they were owned by an IRA or a traditional council, I would suggest. Well, really, the land protection questions are the easy ones.
You said the solicitor. You mean the solicitor for the Department of the Interior, just
right,
today.
Right. That's who I mean, the solicitor for the Interior Department. The land protection questions, it seems to me, are really the easy ones. That if you were to want to protect lands perpetually without a change in the law, that transferring them to a tribal government, preferably one organized under the IRA, would almost surely do it. How you get there, how you transfer the lands, those are other issues. But the real question, and I think the questions that we always find ourselves debating about, and probably which are probably the focus of this roundtable, are the questions of jurisdiction and governance, political authority, political control. And these are, I'm not so sure that they are such difficult legal questions, but they most assuredly are difficult political questions. And so it doesn't really matter whether they're big legal questions or not, because politics can influence law. And the greatest problem, of course, and greatest question arises in Alaska, it seems to me, and I've thought about it for a long time, and that's about all I can say as to why my thinking about it should be legitimate. But it seems to me that the big problem is that there are no reservations. There's enough problems with Indian law, frankly, and the question of the scope of government, tribal government, on reservations. The current Supreme Court has cut away at the scope of tribal government inconsistently, but with some serious effect over the last years. But nonetheless, absent reservations, I think there is nothing else to do but assume that the rules are going to be different. And in fact, the Supreme Court has said so in an Alaska case, one that is much criticized and is confusing and perhaps confused, but and that is Cake versus Egan. But the Supreme Court has fastened, at least in that case and in subsequent cases, on reservations as being significant when it comes to the determination, and maybe even determinative, of the scope of tribal jurisdiction. In the absence of reservations, I would suggest, and do in the paper, that tribally owned land is the next best thing. And that means that the ownership of the land in the village corporations has got to change if your intention is to assure tribal jurisdiction. It is possible to argue that tribes and native villages, and it's credible, have jurisdiction over corporately owned lands. The argument is just stronger when it's tribally owned land. Because, and that I say that, because of the tests that it seems to me the Supreme Court is using to describe the scope of tribal and state jurisdiction in competing when those two powers compete. And that test essentially is a two-pronged and two independent tests. One test is whether the state's jurisdiction is preempted, precluded by a specific federal law from applying to a tribe. The other test, which the Supreme Court has talked about over the years, but to my knowledge has maybe only once and perhaps never employed, is the infringement test. And that is a test which, as I understand it, says that, not too simply, that in the absence of a federal law, in other words, in the absence of preemption, state laws may not infringe on the right of tribes to govern themselves. Now, what the Supreme Court always has said, though, is the right of reservation Indians to govern themselves. There is only one case, to my knowledge, where the Supreme Court has analyzed the effect of the infringement doctrine. And that was in a case called, and I won't read much of this, but a case called McClenahan versus the Arizona State Tax Commission in 1973. It's on page 8 of the paper at the bottom. And there, in the court in McClenahan cited to Cake versus Egan in this discussion. And it said that there are two circumstances in which the infringement test is employed or should be employed. And that is when the state is attempting to exercise, I'm sorry, when the tribe is attempting to exercise jurisdiction over non-natives, non-Indians, and when the state is attempting to exercise jurisdiction off the reservation, the Alaska situation, and it cited Cake versus Egan. And then it said, in these situations, both the tribe and the state could fairly claim an interest in asserting their respective jurisdictions. The infringement test was designed to resolve this conflict by providing that the state could protect its interests up to the point where tribal self-government would be affected. In other words, the in either the off-reservation or non-Indian non-native situation, the tribe and the state may both have interests, and those can be balanced. And the court has gone on in later cases, in very recent cases, to discuss the nature of the balance, that is to the criteria that are to be put in the balance in weighing tribal and state interests. And basically, the closer you get to internal tribal affairs, the greater the protection of a tribal government. Likewise, if the tribal government can attach its exercise of power to its political integrity or economic stability or health and welfare of the members of the tribe, or if it can attach it to consensual relations between it and non-members, then the powers of the tribe are given greater weight in these balances. So that's why I say that tribally owned land tends to enhance all of those criteria. If the tribe owns the land, then its economic interest in the land may be a lot stronger than if the land is owned by a corporation. Similarly, if the tribe owns the land, it's in a position to require consent from people who operate on the land and to establish its jurisdiction that way. So it seems to me that a prerequisite, really, for village home rule, effective village home rule, as I've talked about it, is that the land or some substantial portions of village lands be owned by the village native governments. It's possible that you can do it without that, but it makes things a lot stronger. Let me turn now, if I can, to some of the reasons that I think village home rule makes sense to the state of Alaska, and not just to Alaska Natives, if it makes sense to them at all. In the first place, there are big difficulties with municipal government in Alaska, and it's no secret to anybody that lives here or reads the paper or keeps up with what the legislature does or does not do. The legislature, we probably realize, 1 or 2 years ago attempted to pass a complete revision of Title 29, the state's municipal codes, and that is in limbo as far as I know. But small communities organized under the laws of the state of Alaska, second-class cities typically, less than 400 people, do indeed have many powers. And they're all specified in 55 provisions of 3 statutes, and they can regulate everything from vehicles to insects. But you've got to read those 55 provisions, and you've got to figure out what they mean, and you've also got to rely on a state bureaucracy to tell you what they mean. And that, it seems to me, is the absence of power and local government and local control. It is a system of laws that makes it very difficult for people really to know what they can and cannot control in their communities. And moreover, municipal government offers no protection for native lands. In fact, just the opposite. The temptation on the part of the municipality is going to be to tax property if it has that power. And most second-class cities don't. Home rule in Alaska, on the other hand, moving away from second-class cities and limited municipal government, is somewhat similar insofar as the scope of powers that local governments have, somewhat similar to the kinds of powers that native governments have. In other words, home rule municipalities in the state are presumed to have powers of self-government unless they are prohibited by the laws of the state. And one can similarly say that Native American governments are presumed to have powers unless they are specifically taken away. In fact, this idea of home rule is really entrenched in Article 10, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution. I do think, though, that the village home rule, as I've described it, would be a broader kind of home rule and have a greater scope of authority for native villages than would be possible in many respects for Alaska municipalities. Most notably, villages have the authority, tribes have the authority to establish their own courts. Alaska municipalities, no matter whether it's Anchorage or a small second-class city, have no such authority. Alaska, for better or worse, is constitutionally required to have a unified court system. And that has been held to mean that Alaska municipalities cannot have their own court system. If you want a magistrate in a small village, the presence of the state court in a small village, you have to have a magistrate. In order to get a magistrate, you have to meet criteria, and it has to be funded. And that, in my experience, has been a notoriously slow process. Furthermore, if you have a magistrate and a criminal problem comes before the magistrate, there is a right for the defendant to require a district court judge to hear the case. So a smart defendant can effectively prevent any local judicial hearing on an infraction or any other matter. Native courts are not burdened by that requirement. And so I would suggest that village home rule would be a way to include within the powers that village governments could have the interests that the native community may have, and that those interests could be protected in the native community and excluded from substantial control by the state. I think this idea that I've suggested suggests probably most importantly, the risks and the possibilities of negotiating a settlement or a resolution of the claims of jurisdiction and sovereignty that Alaska Natives, I think, justifiably assert. And we have patterns of previous negotiated settlements, particularly in the case of the Menominee and the Passamaquoddy. We had hoped that someone from Passamaquoddy would be here, but perhaps, and they were unable to make it. But perhaps there are those at the table who can discuss, and perhaps the Oklahoma situation, which I understand is largely off-reservation, and we can come to some appreciation of the possibilities, if there are examples of this kind of home rule in as a negotiated settlement with states elsewhere. This idea that I've suggested may appeal to some because it is an attempt to balance what, let's say, are legitimate interests. And for those of us or you who are interested in balance, that may be a good thing. In any event, and just in final and in conclusion, I would hope that if there is discussion of this proposal, it will enable those of us who are concerned with this issue to better determine the best strategy to pursue when it comes to the question of native land and governance in Alaska. If negotiation is likely to give up too much or result with too little, then that says something about the advisability of negotiated resolutions of these issues, and says something conversely about other alternatives which Ralph Johnson has suggested and which we may well come up with here. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. We'll break for coffee in just a moment, but I should welcome Sheldon Kachetag, President of the United Tribes of Alaska, who's joined us since we began. And I see Sam George here. I don't know whether Willie Casaioli is coming, Sam, or whether he's going to be late, but if you want to take his seat when we resume after coffee, please do. And then when he comes, if he does, we'll leave it up to him to throw you out of there. Maybe after coffee, we might resume this discussion. And I have a suggestion to make about that in light of the fact that members of the Governor's Task Force on State-Tribal Relations are with us today and cannot, I believe, be with us again tomorrow. So perhaps when we resume after coffee, we might ask Tony Vasca to give any comments that he wishes to on David Case's paper. And we might also ask Bob Arnold if he wishes to offer any observations that he thinks are appropriate. I was told you had to leave later on today, Bob. And, so this is your opportunity. And we might also consider the question of principle that I suspect is in the minds of the Governor's Task Force and always comes up, and that is if you have the kind of home rule setup based on native limited sovereignty that David has suggested, you have the philosophical question that non-natives are excluded from participation in that that government. And if that's something that is always at the root of these discussions, and anyone who wants to say something about that should feel free to do so. That is, the question of ethnically based governments is one that we're going to have to struggle with throughout this whole Arctic region. In the James Bay settlement in northern Quebec, the Inuit have a regional government under provincial legislation, and it is not ethnically based, but there, just as in the North Slope borough, the Inuit constitute a great majority of the population. They're about 90% of all the people. They're not at all perturbed about losing control of that government. The Cree under the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement are a minority, so they insisted they have an ethnically placed government under the Indian Act. So it's something that comes up everywhere. Others from the Lower 48 might perhaps be willing to comment on David's paper and what, of course, Ralph said, and tell us, well, you've got these things in the Lower 48. You've got IRAs. You've got reservations. You must have IRAs with some off-reservation jurisdiction. Does the whole thing work, or is it falling to pieces? I think that we would like to hear about that. Well, let's take a break for coffee then.
Simplified without making it, like, you know, aspirations in the sense of